I am Clifton Duhon, founder of Breakthrough Nutrition, here with our friend and co-host, Anthony Almada of Vitargo Global Sciences. And we're bringing to you another episode of NBS Nutrition, a no bullshit look at the sports nutrition industry. Anthony, how are you today?
Hi, Cliff. Good afternoon. Happy Wednesday.
Yeah, Wednesday. Wednesday it is. Hump day, right?
How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling okay, a little off. The subject we're going to talk about and approach tonight, I figured I was going to kind of jump in head first today. I have been no carbohydrate all day. So, you and I are going to talk a little bit about ketogenesis. Ketogenesis, how it relates to performance, especially in endurance athletes. So I started my morning off with some coffee and grass-fed butter and coconut oil. I followed that up with more coffee and coconut oil and grass-fed butter. At 2 o'clock, I gave in and had some cashews. So my brain is a little flat, but I just had some more coffee. So hopefully the caffeine is going to kick in and we'll be okay. But this is definitely something that, I personally would not want to do on a daily basis. But at the same time, it's a very interesting subject. It's one that you and I have talked about a lot, through phone calls and emails and whatnot. I know that you've got, a lot of knowledge on the subject. You just released a podcast with Lava Magazine that came out last week, correct, on the subject? And an article exactly. As well in Lava Magazine that came out last week as well. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, TJ Murphy, we did a podcast that preceded the digital version of the article, and the article was about ketone supplements and performance. But because there's really only one study in humans with ketone supplements, more of it was focused upon ketogenic diets, a really low carb, not too high protein diets. And we reviewed that, talked about in the podcast about the gut microbiome, all the bugs in there, and how they're influenced by diet and how that can influence your whole body, even your brain. Talked about fecal transplants, got kind of dirty on that one, and then just wrapped it up. And then the print article comes out in a week or less in the magazine.
Okay, nice. It's, and this subject is something that's been talked about on a lot of podcasts. It's been growing in popularity in the endurance world. So we're not going to spend a whole lot of time today on the basics of the ketogenic diet and ketones. We will give kind of a brief overview just so that if someone is not familiar with it, they'll get a little bit of basic knowledge, but we can always point them to, podcasts that you've done on the subject, which are multiple. It's not just the ones with Lava Magazine. But today we want to talk more about if you are going to do a ketogenic diet, if you are going to use exogenous ketones, what are things that you should look for? How do you approach it from a performance standpoint? And if we can point to any sort of scientific literature or other that's going to, help out an athlete and see if we can't increase their performance a little bit. So let's start off again, very basic, very brief, just an overview of what a ketogenic diet is.
That would be a diet that typically is under 50 grams of carbohydrate per day, 50 grams of carbs per day, sometimes as low as 25 grams, and it's maintained for periods of weeks to months. Part of the essence and the secret of becoming a ketogenic athlete is to keto adapt, where your brain, which you're being challenged right now, you are metabolically challenging your brain because you haven't adapted to a really low carb diet. I think you said you have like maybe 7 or 8 grams today so far, and it's 2/3 of the day is done. And then also your body fuels shift to being preferentially oriented towards burning ketones. And that is a diet that in the first part, week 4, 7, 10 days is very challenging for most people, or some people at least. There's a brain fog, irritability, mood changes, disrupted sleep, disruptions and impairment in higher intensity exercise, hill climbing, sprint work, high intensity interval training, etc. And just maintaining that. But the key part though is to measure the ketones in your blood.
Right. And I mean, you brought up a great point. But before we kind of get into the whole testing, you know, test don't guess aspect of it, you mentioned ketones. Can you explain to the viewers and listeners exactly what a ketone is?
Sure. So some people, or most people that I know, perhaps some that you know too, they've encountered a person, even themselves, where they have the nail polish remover breath or odor. And one of the ketones, these are classes of chemicals that your body produces when you have a carbohydrate deprived state, could be as short as a day or day and a half, 2 days, and a higher fat intake. And you're not necessarily starving, but you're on a really carb deprived state where your body starts to produce side products that come from an overburning of fats. They're made in the liver, and one of them is acetone. That's where you get that nail polish remover breath or body odor. It's also right. Found in the urine. So you could find that or discern that in the urine. So these are things that are side products of excessive fat metabolism in the face of carbohydrate deprivation.
So essentially, when the body starts to utilize fat as fuel in larger amounts, I mean, because we normally burn fat every day, some fat. But when we start using that as the main source, the ketones are essentially a byproduct of that fuel, correct?
Probably better say in a carb-deprived state.
Okay.
Because you could actually feed someone a large amount of fat before exercise. They'll be burning more fat during that exercise. You could give them caffeine to liberate fats into the blood, but they wouldn't be making significant amounts of ketones. In a carb-deprived state, they would. So that's the key component, carb deprived.
Okay. And I mean, that to me, that's interesting. And that might be something that we could talk about later on, but it's, you know, just, you know, the ketones are the byproduct, but we can still essentially burn fat without going into a ketogenic state. Then, you know, really what's the point of ketosis from a performance standpoint, but we can definitely circle back to that, talk about that later. So you talked about ketones being used by the muscles as fuel, and the ketones can also be used as the brain, by the brain for fuel as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And some would assert that the brain prefers ketones as a fuel. I don't know if we can state that with certainty, but the brain can adapt. That's how people can be in a starvation diet and survive for extended periods of time.
Yeah, Dr. Richard Veach, I'm sure you're very familiar with him. Brilliant guy. You know, the term, you know, from the biochemist aspect and looking at ketones, he's actually stated that, and I'm going to, you know, look at this, you know, to make sure I'm quoting it correctly, but he said that the brain and the heart use ketones more efficiently. But you just said that we can't really, there's no way for us to prove that. Is that correct?
Well, he has done some nice heart work, but it's an out-of-body heart experiment where they take a rat heart, they inject it with things. It's very non-physiological. They haven't shown this in humans yet. But
right.
From that, there's more energy being produced per molecule of oxygen than with other fuels. But it's a non-physiological preparation. It's not the same as you and I being injected with things and measuring how much energy we're producing in the brain or the heart from a ketone versus glucose. So the suggestion is there, the evidence is not.
Gotcha. It's funny. I mean, because one of the benefits of going into a ketogenic diet is that your body produces more ATP at a more efficient, manner, right? So basically less oxygen and more ATP production.
That's the assumption, but it goes back to what I just said. That's based only upon studies in a perfused rat heart that's non-physiological. We don't know yet if that happens in humans intact.
Is there any way that it can ever be proven? I mean, can you study the ATP?
Oh, yes, but that's a very involved study. You'd have to inject non-radioactive tracers. I mean, that's science cocktail hour time.
Gotcha.
It just hasn't been done.
Yeah, all right. So now we know what ketones are, these byproducts of fat burning in a low carbohydrate state. So obviously, just like a lot of things with science, we come across something that's natural in the body. And then our next logical step is, well, if we can produce this product in a laboratory and then we can ingest it, then our performance is going to increase. It makes sense. It's a logical leap, but then there's a lot of dots that we have to connect before we can actually prove that stuff. So let's talk a little bit about exogenous ketones. You would be hard pressed to scroll through a magazine, look on social media without seeing some sort of advertisement for exogenous ketones. And there's, it's kind of broken down into two categories, correct? There's ketone salts and then ketone esters. Can you walk us through what each one of those are?
Sure. So sometimes you'll see like a, say magnesium sulfate or magnesium chloride or calcium chloride. These are things where one part is connected to something else that is a mineral. And so in ketones, the main ketone that the body is oriented towards using and that the body can produce is beta hydroxybutyrate or BHB, boy, happy boy.
Okay.
And the way that they've been available commercially is to connect that ketone, and beta hydroxybutyrate is actually an acid. And to make it stable, they connect it to sodium or calcium or magnesium or potassium, and that forms a salt. And those forms are readily available, but there are two issues that arise with them. One is that to get, that's not good, to get a significant dose, you have to take a lot of sodium or potassium or calcium or magnesium, and that can create some significant GI distress, up or down, top or the bottom, it can come out. And that's a not uncommon experience with consuming ketone salts. The other is that all the ketone salts that are out in the market, they have, it's actually comprised of two forms of BHB. One is the form that's native to your body, and the other is the non-native or foreign form. Your body knows the native form, it doesn't know the foreign form, and those two may compete in terms of being absorbed or being transported to where you want them to go, the brain or the muscle, or being utilized. And that is an unknown factor right now. So if half of it that you're taking in doesn't work or blocks the one that does, are you getting a real effect? We don't know that yet, but there is some preliminary animal and testing evidence that says they indeed are different. So you're getting a salt load or a gut busting load or challenge for some, and two, you're getting a 50% form or half of that ketone is not native to your metabolism.
Okay. So now that's the keto salt. Now, how's a ketone ester different than that?
Thank you for finishing part two of that question for me, or refreshing it for me. So ketone esters actually remove the salt, and they can combine a ketone with another chemical that renders it stable. And the other chemical of the one that's been studied in humans, actually when it gets digested, absorbed, metabolized, gives rise to another ketone. So like a two-for-one punch, or two-in-one, shampoo and conditioner in one, which is nice. And that form, which has been the subject of now two studies, shows that it will raise blood ketones significantly and dramatically. Two, it's allowed by the FDA for use in foods. The other ketone salts do not have that granting yet or allowance by the FDA in the USA. And three, it's only the native form, not the right and left form. It's just the correct form for the body's metabolism.
And so, and you know, we've talked about proprietary blends. We've talked about labeling on product. There are ways that companies guard against what's actually in their ingredient. And it looks like if you look at most ketone, ketone salts, their label doesn't break out how much of the good versus how much of the, we don't want to call it bad, but how much of the unknown is part of that formula, correct?
They describe it just as beta hydroxybutyrate.
Right. You don't know how much of the good versus unknown we're getting in that.
But we do know it's 50%. It's okay, a 50% mix. That's all of them have that, and they don't describe that.
Gotcha.
And some of them don't label it correctly to let you know how much or where it's coming from. They'll just say sodium. They'll say beta hydroxybutyrate, but they won't say sodium beta hydroxybutyrate. That's where it's coming from.
Right.
And so you may see 1 or 2 grams of sodium at one time in the package dose. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a hefty load.
So there.
And that could be problematic. And I must add, if I may, that the ketone ester that I mentioned, the one that's been the subject of 2 studies from Oxford University in the UK, is not available on the market. Right now, it's still unobtainium. Too expensive, not commercially available.
So it's funny you mentioned that. One, Oxford is where Dr. Veach went to college. He works there. He has some relationship with Oxford.
Well, actually, the professor at Oxford, she's Australian. Her name is Kieran Clark, and she's collaborated with Veach. She is part of the National Institutes of Health in the USA. So they have this longstanding collaboration. She's based at Oxford. He's based at the NIH.
Okay. So
Veach is.
There is a new product that hit the market. It's called Ketone Aid. Right, it claims to be the only ester produced with all the good stuff, none of the bad. And right now, it's not for sale in the U.S. to the normal buyer, but I've seen what they're doing is they're actually auctioning off the product. So you can go in, you can bid on one bottle. They say, well, you should bid on two so you can, you know, use it in training and then use it in racing. I mean, have you heard anything about this product? Have you seen anything with it? Any of your athletes used it?
I none of my athletes, or the athletes that I interfaced with, have used it. But it is not, as I understand it, the actual ketone form. And I'm looking at their website right now, and I haven't looked at this for quite a while. But the.
My name is Frank Gilson. I'm co-founder of Ketone Aid. My connection to this whole world.
Let me turn that off there.
And so one of the guys behind this is actually, it's Dr. Veach's goddaughter's husband. So we kind of connect the dots there, but, and he's, I've actually seen some interviews with him. And you know, he's a vegan. He eats a fair amount of carbohydrate through beans, legumes, but he said he's reached 8, you know, millimolars and ketones really, for that, it's not hard for him to do. So it seems like he's got some sort of just genetic predisposition to possibly producing ketones in the blood that most normal people might not have.
But to the point of the Ketone Aid product, it appears to be the actual D form, which is the correct native form. And it appears to be similar, if not identical, to the material that was studied at Oxford. But let's do a very important assessment. How much did they use and how much do you have to buy?
Right.
So it's this scarcity complex. There's only a little bit left. We're auctioning it off. He actually is, I think there's a familiar relationship to Veach. There's a picture of Veach and him on the website. Yet they used, at your body weight, we would be using around 60 grams of ketone ester during a 60-minute ride. Now, if you do the math and you start doing the math and it's economically linked, it's a very expensive ingredient. And so the question is, will you enjoy greater performance by taking in that amount every time? I don't know. You may. Right. And as we've talked about before, some people may not. Some people may not notice, a dramatic improvement, and some may notice an actual reduction in their performance. So that's an expensive trial to perform.
For sure. So as it stands right now, with what is currently on the market, with whether you're getting, there's only ketone salts available on the market right now, correct? Or are there ketone esters as well?
If you exclude Ketone Aid, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So only ketone salts available. The research is, you know, 50-50 at best. We don't know. So what about, so let's look about instead of taking in an exogenous ketone, would using something like ketogenic amino acid, lysine or leucine, would that help fuel the body's natural production of ketones if you're on a ketogenic diet?
I would say that the research right now is very preliminary, Cliff. There's basically only one study that is would be relevant to an athlete, and they use very high doses, and they didn't go into race pace intensity.
Right.
And so we don't know. And that's only with the Oxford material, and the FDA allowed material. I don't know if the ketone aid is the exact same one. I'll have to look into that.
Okay.
And we don't know. There have been no studies done with ketone salts in humans and performance. That's a complete unknown that have been published.
Okay.
But your question about using ketogenic amino acids, the doses that you would need to even achieve a ketone elevation, and I would not expect there to be a ketone elevation, would be prohibitive and gut busting. Gotcha. So I would just take those off the list.
Right off the list. All right. So now let's talk a little bit about ketogenic diets and performance. We're not going to go too in depth in this because we'll point to podcasts that you've done previously that discuss this. But basically right now, there's no study in human performance that's been done at a race pace intensity that has shown an improved performance using a ketogenic diet versus a carbohydrate dependent diet, correct?
As for keto adapted athletes, the answer would be yes. There was one study that showed reduced performance. Came out from a very esteemed group in Australia, and on a podcast with TJ Murphy on Lava Magazine, these two researchers, John Hawley and Louise Burke, they're married. Their names don't indicate that. He didn't take her name. She didn't take his name. And they were two of the speakers at the Ironman Medical Conference last year at Kona. And they took elite race walkers. Some of them are Olympic level, national caliber champions. And they put them on a 3-week ketogenic diet. They got some significant increase in blood ketones. And they also showed the highest rates so far ever of indirect measure of fat burning. But in a race condition situation, their performance was reduced after right. being 3 weeks keto adapted.
All right. And that's one of the things that I definitely want our viewers and listeners to take into consideration, that I don't think it's always fair to look at a study like that, because I've been an athlete that's fueled myself with carbohydrates for years and years and years. I go on a ketogenic diet for 3 weeks, even 3 months. I mean, is that really long enough to become fully, you know, adapted? I would like to see someone that's been keto adapted for 12 months plus versus just a normal fueled athlete, mixture of carbohydrate, protein, and fat. And then look at that at a race intensity and let's see what happens in that study. To me, that's interesting, because we always get the polars, right? One extreme or the other, but what happens when you fall in the middle?
Well, I think your point is very salient and very appropriate. And the only study that could have done that, it didn't do that, was the FASTER study, where they took athletes who were keto adapted for an average of 11 months, and they had them run at a not to exhaustion for 3 hours at a pace that would be notably below a marathon pace or a 70.3 pace, about 62 to 64% of their VO2 max. And they showed that from a muscle biopsy, the group that was keto adapted burned as much or lost as much carbohydrate from their quads as the group that was carb adapted, yet they apparently burn twice as much fat. That would mean they're super inefficient. They have to have all that carb disappear and burn more fat. That's not right.
Yeah.
Errors or oversights in terms of how they measured it, but there was no advantage. There was no advantage shown besides things in the blood.
Right.
We don't know.
Yeah. Listen, I've scoured the internet, unless I'm one person, you know, using Google, whatever else, but I've tried to find studies that basically dispute what we're saying. And again, you and I don't think we really have a preference either way. We want to follow the research. We want to follow the science. And if a ketogenic diet makes you a better athlete, then we would follow that. But just right now, the research isn't there. And every time I found a paper that looked promising, then when you get to the fine print, basically, and you look at the intensity, it just, I mean, we're talking, like you said, 40, 50, 60% VO2 max, and just no one races at that pace. So that brings up a question. Like, what are endurance sports anymore? I mean, I don't know if I would consider a sprint triathlon an endurance sport. I mean, you're running at 90% VO2 max for that effort. You know, you could be looking at an Olympic distance triathlete. You know, the Olympians, they're running at, you know, their red line for an hour, 45, 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Now we're kind of getting into
the second marathoner.
The 70.3s, you know, where those guys are almost like redlined the entire way. I mean, is that still considered endurance sports? You know, it just kind of, to me, it kind of falls in a weird classification because, you know, when you're going that hard, I mean, you're burning tons of carbohydrate. So I don't know. It just seems kind of weird that it's almost like we have to reclassify what is endurance sports nutrition because things are really kind of starting to get blurred.
Well, I think that it's an interesting question. I think the endurance athlete comes into racing at durations that go beyond an hour to 2 hours.
Right.
That's what I've seen. There is no definition of endurance athlete or endurance racing. Like, there's no definition of natural. What is natural? I mean, that's right. Subject of lawsuits, class action lawsuits.
Yeah.
But I think, however, though, and if you're doing an Olympic distance, I mean, I don't know any people that can break 2 hours in an Olympic. I've never met a person. I'm sure they're out there, but that's not. And if you have hill work in there, if you have climbing, that's a unicorn race. So I think in relation to the use of fuels, we have to realize there are some absolutes in human metabolism. Anyone. Is that you're always burning carbohydrate as a certain percentage of the fuel. You cannot change that, period. It's an irrefutable fact. It always happens. Two is that there's always a ratio of fuels being burned. Those two fuels are fat and carbohydrate. Protein is a tiny, trivial, non-significant contributor to the fuels being selected during exercise. Three, we know that muscle in a healthy person will eat up anything. It will take ketones. It will take fats, it will take glucose from wherever it comes from. And depending upon how much you throw at it and the intensity, it will continue to use more and more. But when you start getting to 75%+, 80% race pace at a 70.3 for a good chunk, definitely for an Olympic super, for a sprint, for a marathon, and if you're competitive, you're burning a lot of calories and most of that is carbohydrate, period.
Right. So let's say that, and I do believe there are a lot of benefits of a ketogenic diet. We won't go into that today because it's not really performance-based. It's more brain disease, cancer, things of that nature. But let's say that for whatever reason, you decide that a ketogenic diet is something that you want to try. And because I do think that we should all be our own guinea pig. I mean, I've tried things that, and listen, I will tell you, I have tried a ketogenic diet before, not just today with this little experiment, but back in 90, I guess the first time I tried was in 98 or 99. I read a book. I actually pulled it out of the storage for this thing, but it was a book written by Dan Duchesne back in 96 called The Underground Body Opus. I figured this might get a little response from you.
Very well.
Yep. So if you are watching, here's a picture of the cover. And so this book, it really goes into great detail about ketogenic diets. I will warn you that if you look this up, if you have a copy of it, there it points heavily towards banned substance use. It kind of goes, there's whole chapters of steroids and everything else. Obviously, from the cover that you see, this guy is not really worried about you know, getting tested by USADA or water or anything like that. But so these diets have been around for a while. I've tried it in the past. The second day when I couldn't sleep, I was like, enough is enough. Like, I'm, you know, it's pasta for me. But So you do decide you want to do this for whatever reason. Let's tell the viewers and the listeners, what is a proper way that they should approach this? And let's start, and you've already touched on this a little bit, but let's talk about that macronutrient breakdown that's going to be the best bet for putting you in ketosis. Because I do think there's a lot of misinformation and just a preconceived notion about what a low carbohydrate means ketosis. And that's not true, because your body can actually take protein and turn it into glucose. So if you are going to do this true ketogenic diet, what do your macros look like?
So macros are probably 25 to 50 grams of carbs. Protein is probably around 0.8 to 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, and the rest is fat too, so you are not losing weight. Fat to top it off. And as you said astutely, and this is often not recognized or appreciated, you can overconsume protein, and that will serve some of the amino acids will serve as a precursor to glucose. We know from studies that have been done in resistance-trained males is that if you've taken more than about 0.1 grams of protein per pound of body weight in one dose after training, let's say, your legs, anything above that will be wasted, burned for fuel, converted into glucose, and lost in the urine as waste products. So if you have a 40-gram protein meal, a lot of that is gone,
right?
Especially if you haven't done any training. So being mindful of the macros and knowing that it may be less than 50 grams, maybe 20 grams, the only way you can determine if you're ketogenic is by measuring blood. And the best way to measure blood, the most accurate way to measure blood, is to take it from your vein and have it sent to a lab. The second best is to get a finger prick and get a ketometer, but those test strips are not cheap. And some of the test strips don't work, and you can get variability test retest within a minute on a certain ketometer. But it's better than urine, far better than urine. And I would say there are more data on the test strips for blood from a finger than there are for breath. Breath is still, the new ketometers are still not enough data yet to support them. So measure where you are first, and if you can, measure every week. And venous blood is the best way to get that done. And then if you can maintain that for a few to several weeks, which you have not been able to do, Cliff, admittedly, then you now may be entering into that hallowed realm of being keto adapted. But the other thing to have measured before and after is performance. You have if you got a watt meter on your bike, wherever you have it placed, you do a certain climb, you measure before when you're on your regular diet, you measure it again, perhaps every 2 weeks. And if it's a higher intensity climb, it may be disappointing to see that there is no change or that it goes down. If it's a lower intensity climb, you may say, gosh, I was able to endure longer. I don't feel as depleted. But it all depends on the intensity. And if you go back to the 1981 study where they measured ketones and they put them 4 weeks pro cyclist group, five of them, they showed and described in that study, just a little slight mention, then 20 some years later, that their performance during climbing was reduced because it's higher intensity. So just be mindful of and allow your body to adapt to being lower performing on higher intensity work days.
Yeah, there's a lot of the studies that I looked at, and they would basically do a baseline test, then they would do a test maybe like a week later when you weren't fully adapted, and then maybe another test 4 weeks after that. And there was some improvement shown from the baseline, and there's a drop in week one, and then you go back up, sometimes baseline, sometimes higher. But again, all that was at just a very lower intensity. So essentially we just need to make sure that, like everything else, that your nutrition plan parallels your goals. So if your goal is to go out and climb, a hill, a mountain, then the ketogenic diet might not be the best thing for you. If you're going to do like a 24-hour ruck march, like Go Ruck is some of the, it's pretty popular these days, something like that, it could be beneficial because it's just, I'm going all night, all day. with a lower intensity type work. And I mean, there has been a decent amount of study with ketogenic diets in the military, you know, especially in the Navy SEALs and diving. And that's a little bit different, different topic. But I mean, at least there are some people looking at that sort of aspect, correct?
Yes, and it's very intriguing. In fact, Dom DiAgostino out of Florida is looking at it also in undersea conditions, being in a ketogenic or keto-adapted diet for prolonged periods of time in different pressure chamber conditions, which is very interesting. And that study is being sponsored by NASA, but we don't know what that's about a year and a half away. But I would offer, though, that if you are going to race, and we've talked about this, carbohydrates during race and being keto adapted are likely critical. I will offer a plug to our book we came out with at the end of last year, Keto Diets and Performance, Are You the One? That's on thinksportsnutrition.com. Just email, we won't spam. You get a nice treatment on the data, the studies on keto adaptation and performance. We give you some guidelines as to how to eat and what to measure if you are a keto adapting or seeking a keto, being a keto adapted athlete.
Right. And we'll definitely put a link up to that as well. We want our, you know, we want our listeners and viewers to get the best information out there possible. So let's talk about, I'm on a keto diet, right? I've eaten my macros properly. I've been tested. I know that my ketones are elevated. I'm burning fat as fuel. I'm okay with where my performance is, right? I've got an ultra endurance race coming up. So I know that I'm going to need some carbohydrate during that race. How do I start to fuel my body the days leading up to the race and then the day of the race itself so I can get the most bang for my buck?
What we don't know I haven't seen any studies that actually address this, but we do know and speak with a number of athletes that are keto adapted and friends of athletes that are keto adapted that the typical practice is the night before, the day before a race. And you said ultra endurance, Cliff, which would mean perhaps more than 2 hours in length, 4, 24, 100-mile race, a century race on a bike, et cetera. So that could mean lower intensity. But if you have issues related to extra climbing, if you are envisioning a lot of overtaking, those will create greater carbohydrate demands. So the day before, the night before, the morning before. So if your race begins, if your wave goes out at 8 in the morning, you would have some carbs at 6:30 or 7, depending upon how you can tolerate carbs. And then periodically throughout the race, the challenge for a keto-adapted athlete when they go to carbs is that the enzymes that help digest carbs have gone on vacation. And so you may experience the night of and the day of, night before and the day of, stomach rumblings, bloating, gas, diarrhea, because you can't digest, absorb some of the carbs depending upon what you're ingesting.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I know you talk a little bit about that in your podcast on Lava Magazine. But so essentially, once we start eating a high-fat diet, our gut microbiome changes, right? The enzymes that in there change because we're feeding it different fuel. So it starts to essentially migrate to what it needs to possess in order to process these calories. And then if we introduce another form of calorie, a carbohydrate, essentially those enzymes, they're not necessarily dead, but they're sleeping, they're, you know, from lack of use. So then you ingest, especially a bunch of sugar, then we're talking about gut bloat, gut rot, things of that nature. Is that correct?
Well, it's more along the lines of carbs that have to be digested, because we know that the pancreas makes carb digesting enzymes, and those go on rest or hiatus when you expose the gut to a lot less carbs. The gut microbiome, the bacteria there will change. And we know from one study done with almost 1,000 people that if you have feed them a certain carb food and do a glycemic index test, there will be significant variability between people. And part of that is defined by their gut flora, the bacteria that are in there.
Anthony, thank you so much. It's a lot of great information. You know, we definitely gave our All right, Anthony, thank you so much. I know we gave our viewers and our listeners a lot of good information as far as an overview of ketogenic diets and studies and how you set yourself up for success with the macronutrient profile of a true ketogenic diet. Still lots of things to talk about, especially how do we fuel ourselves on race day, what products are available on the market. So join us next time when we will discuss various products and how they might help elevate your performance while on a ketogenic diet. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.